This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Hi, I'm Peter Terzakian, and welcome to another edition of ARC Energy Idea Podcasts.
And I'm Jackie Forrest.
Well, this week we have a special guest who's going to talk to us about renewable energy.
Yeah, we'd like to introduce Grant Arnold, CEO of Blue Earth Renewables, power generator that's headquartered here in Calgary. So Grant, welcome, and tell us a little bit about Blue Earth.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. Blue Earth is an independent power producer. We're, as you said, based in Calgary. We generate wind, hydro, and solar power with sites across Canada and the U.S.
Good. Well, so you are definitely qualified to talk to us about what's going on with the renewables. And lots has happened in 2018. Some of it lost, I think, with all the oil news at the end of the year. So we really wanted to highlight some major things that are happening here at the provincial level, other provinces, Canada, and then beyond when it comes to the renewable space. And obviously, you've got perspective on all of those with your role at Blue Earth. So the first one I wanted to highlight was how Alberta was a leader in Canada for new renewable contracts in the year. And many of us probably missed this, but December 17th, two renewable auctions were announced and a fair amount of new renewable capacity in Alberta was agreed to. And in total, and we look at all of the contracts, there was an auction in the end of 17 as well. We now have 1,300 new megawatts of renewable energy coming in over the next few years in Alberta.
Yeah, it was a very, very big year, and it's part of the current government's 5,000 megawatt target. And they've definitely contracted power projects for a very, very low price, which is why it's so noteworthy.
So can you tell us, just give us a sense of perspective, 1,300 megawatts was auctioned, 5,000 is a target. Like, what do we have total here in Alberta?
In context, the grid, normally with all forms of generation, sort of average throughout the year might run at 8,000 megawatts, and that's all forms, hydro, coal, and gas, and renewables already. In a peak day in the summer, you can get over 10 on the big days. So 5,000 megawatts of wind is a material amount, but it does coincide with the coal retirement plans that go, you know, back to previous provincial governments and federal governments as well.
Now, let's get to the prices, because they were very low. The rounds that came in were similar to the first round, but basically around 3.8, 3.7 cents a kilowatt hour. To put that in comparison, Ontario had a large renewable procurement in 2016 that was 8.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So these are really cheap projects. Now, is that because they were just projects that had very low costs, maybe some infrastructure, and they're a unique case? Or do you think this is pretty representative of wind power in Alberta? Oh, by the way, they were all wind, too.
They were all wind, and it is representative, and it is a function of trends we're seeing everywhere. So a couple things to hit on in terms of the pricing concept. The price of renewables, wind specifically, and also solar, which we can get to in more detail, has dropped consistently for a number of years, and I mean materially. So that's global. We've seen that everywhere. You get other factors that are important when you talk about Alberta versus Ontario, for instance. One is difference in resource. This is a wind speed type game. So Alberta and Saskatchewan, for example, have a much better wind resource than Ontario, just the nature of the physics that give us this energy. It's also about construction and ease of construction, but it also ties into programs or things that certain governments want to add to the contracts that can change their price.
I was going to say, I mean, there's a lot of this is also the cheaper cost of capital. In other words, the cost of money to finance these things is in greater abundance today.
Absolutely true. There is a lot more equity and debt and, you know, project capital looking for a home in renewables, following global trends. There are also long life contracts, but very definitely the cost of capital trend is making this very, very aggressive.
So
do you
see it going lower? It's like 3.7 cents. That's pretty low.
It is really low. There is room for wind to get a bit lower. We're super careful about what's driving that. I mean, you have to keep in mind that there's things in here like foreign exchange when you're buying turbines. You can't buy wind turbines in Canadian dollars. So, you know, there's room for a number of things to get lower and machines to get more efficient. But, you know, wind is a 30-plus-year-old technology. It's very mature technology. But the people out there that are experts in this on these pricing issues say there's still room to drop in wind. Agreed, Peter, that it's hard to imagine that we can keep getting there. I think we're seeing wind in a place where it's going to be smaller and smaller increments, because you're now getting into, you know, the impact on, like, let's say, landowner payments that you have to make and things like that, is those you can't compress.
Those are fixed. Yeah.
Property tax, things like that. So yeah. I see it harder and harder to drop, but solar is another story yet.
Yeah, let's talk about solar. So interestingly enough, the U.S. had a lot of new power agreements last year in solar, and the numbers were even lower, like 2.1 to 2.5 cents per kilowatt. Now, I recognize they have some subsidies in the U.S., so it's not maybe apples to apples. But why are we not seeing any solar bids here in Alberta with these renewables?
A couple things on solar pricing. Even without the subsidies, because a lot of the subsidies in the U.S. for these projects aren't there anymore, but even without subsidies, solar is becoming a very cheap product. And there's a bunch of things that we should talk about before we get into the differences again in the U.S. But solar has dropped more materially than most sort of things we think about from a bricks and mortar perspective. Solar is almost consumer electronics.
Yeah, I mean, it's dropped in the last 5 years, just like 80% or something.
That's the number that I have in my head too.
Yeah.
And part of that is the efficiency of the machines or the panels themselves. They get better and better. But the pricing is a function of manufacturing scale and things like that. So if you're changing how much is being made every year from a panel count and its orders of magnitude, mm-hmm. it's going to get cheaper, just like flat screen TVs and things like that. So solar has moved a ton. Now, why is it different region to region when the resource isn't as different? It doesn't vary as much as, let's say, wind. And we have a very good resource here, because you have to keep in mind that it's not just the amount of sunshine, it's the temperature. This is an electrical product. The hotter it is, the less efficient it is. So there's some other factors in there, but the differences in price aren't all made up by resource differences. The difference between certain regions is a lot to do with cost of labor, because solar farm construction has a lot more labor than, let's say, a wind farm does, which is buying the turbine itself. So the contractors we work with that cross borders will say that the sort of the cost of labor in Canada on a solar project, you know, just isn't as efficient as it is in some places. So if you go to other parts of the world, we're seeing solar and wind fight head-to-head for price, and all other forms of generation being much higher than that. In Canada now, we're seeing wind cheaper than all other forms of energy, but solar hasn't gotten there yet, and the big difference is probably something to do with labor cost.
That's interesting. I would have thought just because of our short days in the winter that you wouldn't have as much utilization, but...
But we have longer days in the summer.
Right.
And we have a cooler base temperature, and there is some reflection off snow. So these things all kind of balance out a little bit. You're still going to do better with a solar farm in the Atacama Desert is going to be a better performer than even a good wind farm in Canada. Like there's a lot of variation, but generally it's still a remarkable thing to watch.
So it sounds like even going forward to build out to the target that we're going to see more wind.
True. Yeah, it's still in Alberta and Canada, we're still going to see more wind first, I think. Solar is coming fast. And you have to keep in mind, too, that solar is a different product. Solar is a peak day product, which the grid sort of wants.
Right. The when it comes on is different. Let's talk a bit about, you mentioned it's cheaper than all other forms of energy, including natural gas generation. And I'm referring to some data from Lazard, which is a group that puts out an annual report on North American average costs for different types of power generation and basically what is the price needed to justify new investment. We've been talking about numbers like 4 cents for wind and maybe 2.5 cents for solar. And they're showing that a natural gas combined cycle was somewhere between 4 and 7 cents per kilowatt hour in North American average. And so, you know, would you agree that at today's just on pure generation that natural gas is more expensive?
I agree. That's what we're seeing everywhere. It is a different product. You know, gas that we're seeing built now in those price ranges is a peaking product. It augments the grid. It helps everything else run. So, but we're seeing that globally. In fact, there's countries that we're, you know, investigating and we're working on deals. And the power calls don't specify type of generation, and renewables are beating gas-fired.
So just to be clear with our audience, there is a base load power, which is
correct
electricity that is produced on an ongoing basis, a certain amount. And then there's peaking that we need in the mornings when everybody wakes up in the morning and fires up the coffee pot. And then again, the big rush later in the afternoon around dinner time, early evening.
Correct. So the grid operates based on what we call the load. And the load is that what you're saying is this diurnal variation of consumers of all kinds, including, you know, shopping malls
right.
and heavy industry and the oil patch, plus that household consumption. And there is a peak that in Alberta is sort of a midday to late day peak. And then it's, of course, varies over the weekend.
So let's look at the composition. What is the base load going to be in Alberta, like as we go forward?
As we go forward with the coal retirements, the base load will be a combination of some hydro and natural gas, and the coal retirements spread over many years.
So coal gets phased out, natural gas comes in, shifts from being the historical peak to more of the base load, and then on top of this, we'll see more renewables, wind, some solar, and also the new age coming of battery and wind and solar together.
Correct. And I think you can add in depending on the time frame you're looking at, is some you know, distributed generation, which we call like your household scale solar or a commercial scale solar. There's also a major part of the grid operation is sort of an intertie. So this concept of these major transmission lines we have to Montana and to British Columbia. So that makes up, you know, part of the key grid operation that does, you know, help with the base load concept. And on top of that, the grid, regardless of the type of generation on the grid, there's always this reserve amount that's spinning and not spinning that allows load to vary and generation to vary because, you know, energy is electricity is not storable. So
when we talk about the grid, these transmission lines, these really big ones, and we're still building those, right?
Correct.
And so how does that reconcile with what you just said, the sort of increasing move and a lot of buzz and talk about distributed systems where instead of plugging into these high tension lines that communities and individual homes will generate electricity much more locally?
This is where we get into what's happening everywhere, certainly in the first world, this disruption. So, you know, when you look at grid planning and major transmission lines, what we have today is a system that was built for sort of large thermal plants that weren't near anybody and bringing that large amount of electricity to load.
Right. Coal, and natural gas.
Correct. Yeah. Big hydro. So that was all, and this gets into transmission planning as well, because even renewable resources are, you know, you're going to flow from areas of not very much load into larger cities. It's a concept that without dealing with renewables as we've been dealing with for a long time. So it's something that grid operators and incumbent utilities are dealing with everywhere, is this amount of disruption that comes from generating locally and not needing the wires.
So if disruption is on the way, like, why are we building more big transmission lines?
Partly price. So the numbers we're talking about are all for major what we call utility scale projects. So go where the resource is, build where you can capture that resource for the least amount of money and move that electricity to where the load is. Mm-hmm. And that's mixed with smaller scale distributed generation on shopping malls or large buildings or houses. And that's just slower to take off because it's more expensive because you're putting, you know, just from a capital perspective and the amount of work it takes to put those in, we could do it cheaper somewhere else. So as things change and we're not in a position of land constraint for these resources, it's a balance of those things. And I think the pricing stuff would show us that there's a slower, more gradual uptake of the distributed generation.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll skip ahead maybe to this example I had. I think the potential of a disruption is there, but I'm not sure the economics are there. So I want to share with you a little exercise I did. So I looked at my own power bill. So
that's got to be high.
Yeah. It's not, you know, I live in a, you know, fairly average house, $100, less than $100 a month. A third of that is electricity. 2/3 of that is transmission cost, distribution, administration, all that stuff. And, you know, this is the piece that we're all as consumers paying for by the current model. You know, like we're having to pay all these overheads to pay for these big transmission lines for 20 years. In theory, I could avoid this model, put solar panels on my roof and a huge amount of batteries in my basement. And I could just cut myself off and I don't have to worry about paying all those fees anymore.
You'd be off grid.
Off grid.
Yeah.
So actually Grant hooked me up with someone to talk to me about what it would cost to get the solar panels. Mm-hmm. So that's like about $20,000.
Right.
So you remember I'm paying like $100 per month for my power bill.
Yeah, by 3 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yeah, so basically 16 years before I get, with no interest in here, no time value of money to get my money back. Plus I didn't pay for those batteries in my basement yet. Yeah. And actually battery prices are really coming down. There was just a very interesting auction in Hawaii where they were like 8 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour for batteries. But even then, that's kind of adding, you know, another three times to the cost here. So I'm probably looking at like a 45-year payback for me to get off the grid. Yeah. So I'm not doing it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a challenge. Is if you have a auction that is priced at 3.8 cents a kilowatt hour and you have the established infrastructure of the grid, it's very difficult to justify paying a whole bunch of money up front to go off grid. Is that right?
Correct. We and as a society, we have a large sunk cost in
sure.
that grid. And it's also, I think, your example. And for the listeners, I have no affiliation with the person that gave you that quote, just for the record. There's no kickbacks or anything. And becoming completely off grid is a different cost than, say, consuming 60% of your own electricity with solar panels on your roof or something. So there's always this, what does that tail cost you to get to 100%? But it's a pretty interesting dynamic because the grid and this, what we're facing and what we're seeing everywhere is grid operators are recognizing that the utility model means that everybody that's on the grid pays for the grid and all the energy that the grid needs. Now, if the biggest consumers that can do something different start to leave the grid because they want a different product, then the follow-on effect to those of us that can't make a change at our household level or something.
Right, like a manufacturing plant that decides to, pardon the pun, short circuit the grid.
Correct.
And put up solar panels on the roof and batteries and whatever.
That means
that we have to absorb a greater amount of the cost. The thing that was on your
right,
utility
that's
gonna bill.
Keep increasing.
That's gonna keep increasing.
It's already like 2/3 of the bill, right?
Yeah. So that's the most interesting part of this, and where we're seeing massive disruption at the generation level, and you're seeing these costs that you talked about drop and drop and drop. The changes at the household level aren't as evident yet. And the question is, let's say in a place like Alberta, how long does that take? Because if you go to places like California or other parts of the world where people have traditionally led in these kind of things and changing and disrupting, those things are happening. So if you're listening and you're looking this up, in the utility world, it's referred to as the spiral. So what happens when things start to change and the people that want to change and can afford to make a change because they are the biggest consumers or whatever the case, it does have an effect. So, you know, all this is positive change, and it's going to take a long time, but it's certainly a major factor in what we're thinking about as our business.
You know, it's really interesting because let's bring it down to us as Albertans, as consumers. And of course, the biggest question is my utility bill going to go up? The common perception is that with renewables coming in and the mandated amount of renewables that the provincial government's put into place, the price is going to be driven up because renewables are more expensive. That's not really the issue. The issue potentially in the future is that the technological disruption of the grid and, as you say, the large industries that can afford to get off grid and leave us paying the bills for the legacy grid is what's probably going to drive our price up.
I believe that. That's what I'm seeing. The price of new renewables coming on the grid is less than, and in many cases, matching merchant mm-hmm. price. So, yeah, the cost thing that we'll all have to face and deal with and manage is a transition to mm-hmm. a different model at the utility level.
Right. Now, these new wind turbines that are being put in based on these auctions, they are going on the grid, obviously.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are utility scale. These are major pieces of equipment.
Yeah.
These are, you know, $200 million, $400 million wind farms.
Now, this isn't happening overnight in terms of this grid obsolescence. As you said, it's going to take time.
Correct.
And so the near-term outlook for Alberta electricity prices is what is still pretty cheap, right, relative to the rest of the country and the world?
Correct. And pricing in Alberta is a merchant concept. It is a supply and demand-driven bit of math every hour, which is different in other provinces and other states. But right now, with sort of a less demand from the industrial side in Alberta, and new power coming on very cheaply, it's actually pretty cheap power.
Definitely. So we don't have to worry about rising electricity costs, in your opinion?
I don't think so.
Over the next several years, but down the road, as we see this technological disruption, legacy grid versus new distributed technologies, that could potentially have an issue.
Definitely.
But I'm thinking, based on the economics I just ran today, recognizing a commercial operations would have better economics, but it's 10 plus years away, mm-hmm. would you say?
I think less, personally. You know, I think the level of competition we can find in putting panels at a household level in Calgary, Alberta might be different than you could find in San Diego, for example. So, you know, I think that's a part of this is going to be disrupted as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just in Alberta. I want to move on to another topic. Another big thing that happened in Canada this year, where we might have been the leaders here in Alberta for renewable Ontario, was the laggards, because they canceled a renewable power agreement. So Doug Ford came in June, becoming the premier of the province, shortly after announced 270 renewable contracts would be canceled. Now, I think there will be lawsuits on this, but does this change the risk-reward profile for new renewable projects in Canada? Because if the Alberta government changes, we've already heard Jason Kenney of the United Conservative Party is talking about not liking the renewable policies and thinking that they're costing Albertans money. Do you think people will stop participating, stop bidding on these projects because of this precedent?
No. And I just talk about a couple of things in that question. In Ontario, the Doug Ford government canceled renewable contracts, and the vast majority of those were projects that were under development. They weren't operating or under construction. There was one project under construction, I believe, that was impacted, and I have no inside information, but the last I heard, there was termination payments made to that owner of that project. Another part of this question is really the nature of infrastructure type projects. So power projects or roads or airports, these are capital intensive projects that take a long time to get built. And they're built because there's an offsetting contract for a very long period of time. If those contracts are not bankable, and by bankable, I mean, if there's risk, they can be canceled, then they just don't get financed. They don't get built. And that model exists because that's how you make these products and services cheap. You find debt and there's a huge market for this where that makes the cost of a toll road or the cost of an airport service fee or the cost of an electron from a power plant very cheap. If that financing is no longer available and whoever's providing capital, be it debt or equity, sees huge risk in that contract being canceled, then they won't get built.
So you're saying there is a risk?
There always is a risk anywhere in the world. Will it happen? You're stepping out of the bounds of contract law and certainty that people look for in terms of where they invest their money in the world. And if you create an environment where that investor or any investor sees that it's happening in one power contract and it's not handled in a way that reflects contract law, you're going to see a flight of capital. That's my belief, in power.
But you're saying you think in Ontario generally they have respected the law and are compensating people for the costs that they incurred.
To be fair, the contracts in Ontario that have not reached a certain point of development, very clearly in the contract it says you won't get reimbursed for your costs.
Mm-hmm. So maybe not as bad as it sounds just in the news headlines.
But the other dynamic here is that to this point, a lot of the renewable build out has been predicated on these contracts that are government backed. And as the costs have come down so dramatically and will continue to go down going forward, the influence or the necessity of government starts to diminish.
I think that's a fair comment sort of over decades, and I think that's happened already. I mean, Alberta is deregulated. Most other provinces, you have to deal with the Crown or its agent to sell power. Many parts of the states are deregulated. So it's happened over time. And I think you're correct that how this plays out and the power of the consumer here starts to facilitate other forms transacting on electricity.
So deregulated meaning free market, that it isn't the prices and operations are not so much state controlled. In other words, controlled by the province or the state.
Correct.
Like if it is 3 cents a kilowatt hour, then why wouldn't you just build it anyway? If you think the power prices in Alberta will be higher than that long term, you don't necessarily need the guarantee of a government contract.
And I think you're going to see some of that. I'm not sure where this is all going to go because it's very, very dynamic. This is very, very fast moving stuff compared to what the sleepy electricity industry used to be.
Yeah. But before we move on, the listeners, a lot of them are in the natural gas business. So what does this mean for them?
I think let's bring it down to Alberta. I think that the facilitation of change on the grid with renewable prices being so low in a province where we have tremendous renewable resources, and it's a great story, fits very well with gas-fired power. And again, this gets into the question of, do you go to sort of 100% renewable grids, or is there a way to optimally manage the price of power totally, plus low emissions, and balance the grid, reliably? I think natural gas has a huge role to play personally.
Right. So big loser in the near term, coal being phased out, high cost, high emissions, et cetera, relative to natural gas plus renewables for the base load and the peaking and so on. And then further down the road, the interesting dynamic of more localized electricity production.
Correct.
But I want to disagree with you, Peter.
Okay.
Because some people, we go beyond our bubble, believe that 100% clean energy or 100% renewable can happen and that we won't need natural gas. And there's lots of news in this last year around that. So California adopted 100% clean energy target by 2045 called SB 100. But they're not alone. We also had Hawaii, New York State, DC, Sierra Club says over 100 cities have made this pledge. Mm-hmm. We even have power, big utilities like Xcel Energy, a major US utility, wants to be carbon free by 2050. Like, I guess that is down the road a ways.
Yep.
But Grant, to your point about the grid and needing base load, like, do you think 100% renewable is possible? And I wanted to talk a little bit about the change of language. Some of the earlier pledges were 100% renewable, and this year we're seeing more 100% clean energy.
Correct. Yeah. And there is careful distinction made by all the people doing this, but I guess my point in this is, what if it's 99% and that costs us a material amount less than 100%? And again, this is all coming because you've got a mix of cheap solar and wind, let's say. Batteries are getting cheaper and cheaper, and we're seeing, I think, Jackie, you quoted some numbers for the Hawaii deal. That's actually generation plus storage.
8 to 12 cents, generation combined. Plus storage. And by the way, you know, sometimes these are confusing because they say you've got the generation and the storage, but the storage is just a tiny little bit and only provides power for a short duration. Do you think these are actually projects that reflect more equal amount of storage for what you would need to back up the generation?
Those are, my understanding of those projects, they're full plant capacity storage for 4 hours. So if you think about a solar plant in Hawaii, when the sun goes down, you've got 4 more hours of that level of power.
So, okay, so these might be like the real deal in terms of providing reliable power that would meet needs kind of throughout the whole day.
And that's the key, is this timing to get you from sundown past dinner time. So you get this diurnal thing that Peter was talking about, where the load starts to drop off. So yes, I guess to go back to the original question, you can get to 100% renewable. I think you can. I think in our time frame of thinking and planning for assets, we're sort of in a few decades where gas fired is a great balance to help us get there. But my question for all of us, obviously I'm biased as a generator of renewables, but I'm also a consumer of power and trying to make this, a very stable thing. You know, I think the real question is how long before you're at 70 or 80 or 90%. And that's probably reasonably soon.
And that is going to, I mean, I'm under no illusion that over time, over the next 25 years, the natural gas demand for power generation is going down.
Well, and, you know, California's something to watch. They're obviously always leaders in this space, but today they're 30% renewable. So they're already where Alberta wants to get to. And as part of this goal, they want to reach 50% by 2025. So they are quickly going on this trajectory.
Yeah, they're quickly going. But I think we have to remember that California already has quite high power prices. Like what is it? I mean, equivalent 20 cents or something like that? 15, 20 cents.
I don't know.
But it's quite high. It's not 3 cents.
Yeah.
And so the higher it is in a jurisdiction, the more latitude you have for cheaper stuff to come in. Here in Alberta, we're very fortunate. We have it all. Like, we've got all the resources, wind, sun, natural gas, you name it. And so when you have natural gas coming from out of the ground for almost for free, it's much more difficult to displace.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. The numbers I quoted, Lazard, that's like, U.S. gas prices, which are like 3 times higher than ours, approximately.
It's a major factor. It's also why I believe that for Alberta as a transition product.
Yeah, I mean, your energy mix for all these things depends on your regional circumstance and the relative costs of each. But there's no question that these renewables are coming down in cost. And also, say, over the course of the next 25 years, these 2050 all renewables, I mean, it's going to change. And then we've also got the grid disruption layered on top of it. So it's really a very exciting time, not only here in Alberta. In some ways, we're leaders in the changes that are happening. And we are the beneficiaries, I think, of the learning curve effects of other jurisdictions like Ontario and Europe, which really drove the cost of these renewables down over the last 10 years. That's why, in part, our power prices are coming in at these auctions are so low, right?
That's correct. And we've got a great story here. I think you touched on it. We've got another bunch of resources to develop here in Alberta that are positive on so many fronts for us.
Yeah.
I'd also say, you know, for those that that want to watch how this happens, I think we've talked about California and Hawaii. Those are traditionally places that lead. You know, how long does everything take to roll out commercially or from a regulatory perspective to let's say Alberta or somewhere else from California or Hawaii? Depends, but it always happens. It has historically forever. So,
well, thanks very much for coming in, Grant. It's been great to have you. Lots of exciting change. And when I see change and disruption like this, I know it's a little bit unnerving, but I find it actually very exciting. So thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.